And one of them that was torn out of the ceilings was Dave Boggs' drop to his Dorado at his desk. He's one of the few people, I think, that had a Dorado in his office. It was so noisy that that he tolerated it. So anyway, it's Boggs' Ethernet drop, and Ken said, does the Digibarn need an artifact? I said, I grovel at your feet.
Bruce, excuse me, before you put it down, I just want to point out a very important feature of this, which is that it's clamped onto the wire on the coax. So this is a clamp with a big screw. So that means that you didn't have to cut the coax. The coax was going around the building, and when you wanted to install a new so-called tap, like a phone tap, you clamped this clamp on it, and that created the connection sometimes. If it didn't, if it didn't connect, you went with the wrench and kind of tightened the clamp a little bit. But I think it's a very important feature that that the coax was continuous and it was stabbed into.
One of the reasons that it wouldn't work sometimes is that they clamped them into the air conditioning line. When they did that, they had to leave it, otherwise the air conditioning would stop.
Ron,
another reason they didn't work, by the way, was that gophers like to eat this cable. When we ran them from one part building to another, Ethernet went very flaky and turned out the gophers were eating the cable. So we actually came out with a new specification for the cable, which turned out to be gopher proof. Maybe this is one.
It's a little bit of history. This was designed to host 10 megabit Ethernet, which was, I guess, the Dorado. Is that a three?
Yeah. Okay,
that's a three.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks,
Ken. We were one of the last places in the world to get 10 megabit Ethernet. Because after all, we had all this stuff.
And it worked just fine.
It worked.
So
what was before 10 megabit?
There's a few other great artifacts upstairs, some original Xerox publications. This is the 76 Alto User's Handbook, which you guys. Sort of a Bible for people who came into using the Alto. Surprisingly, the 79 handbook isn't much thicker than this. Surprising stability and lack of code bloat. there's some artifacts here, like there's the park baseball team. So some of you who are older people could probably find yourself or your spouses in this picture. This is from Ron Cude. And some things that have been lost to history, like the key set.
Good riddance.
Yeah.
Don't even disagree with
him. I repeat, good riddance.
And many of you may note that there's another little project that Digibarn's been involved with, which is the Maze War Resurrected project. Maze War, if you don't know about it, was the first, arguably the first multi-user 3D graphical multiplayer game that was developed on MLAX PDS-1. At Ames, and it got moved to so many platforms. And it was actually the core intellectual property behind today's multi-user massive multiplayer role-playing games. And it was on Alto, and in the mid-70s, the sound of keysets going after hours, people playing Maze War at different locations, because it was a heart-stopping game. It was after hours because a memo went out requesting people to play it after hours because it was taking up to half the packets in the ARPANET. So,
the Ethernet,
right. I'm an amateur historian. I get to be corrected a lot of times. But we'll be showing, John Silly Brown gave me this about 16 years ago. It's the compendium of the research done, incredible research done at Park in the first 10 years. And you'll see wonders like a 2.5 megabyte platter. This was Ron tells me that people who in their offices had 10 to 20 of these were considered way out on the edge. Why would they need so much disk space? Now this platter.
That is still a very good question.
Now Charles, this platter is, we pulled this out of the archives back here for display, is in honor of UFC Bravo X 5.4.
Brilliant. Thank you so much.
No, it's not been given to you, but
I get to touch it.
You get to touch it.
You get to run
re-content.
I'm honored.
The recontent.
Oh, we got to run it.
Yeah. And the last thing is that until very late at night. We were inside this machine trying to get it working, and it's down to one failed power supply that burns out every fuse that it is inserted into it. So now we're, I think later I'm going to try to, you'll actually be able to see if Ron is here, you'll be able to see Ron, who probably maintained and fixed over 1,000 Altos in his career, on his back in the position that he was in for years, trying to keep Altos running. So you'll see him replacing a power supply, and maybe we'll be able to run Bravo, which, if you don't know, is the sort of great-grandfather of all WYSIWYG on-screen document systems. And with that, I'm Bruce Damer. I just failed to be introduced and didn't introduce myself. I just want to acknowledge some other people who couldn't be here. There's a number of people who are considered fathers of this machine and this legacy, Butler Lampson being one. But you can't really see this, but Butler gave us permission to reproduce his 1972 memo to Xerox Management that requested resources to build a number of computers at Park they were going to call Alto. And the interesting thing is that it kind of lays out the roadmap. And this is on the DigiBarn site. If all this stuff is co-sponsored by the DigiBarn Computer Museum. This is my wacky project along with Alan Lindell and my partner Galen, to kind of really capture, kind of do a lot of what this museum does, but we focus on systems that we're actually running, and we're capturing oral history, like I'm recording this right now, really doing the oral history and trying to tie the connections between people together. Who knew what, and what information went between what people? The sort of the connections map of the human, the sociogram of the birth of digital computing. But if you look at some of the, sort of read some of this, these are the specifications for the Alto before they were first built in 1973, talking about the raster monitor using, deciding to use square pixels, which we stick with, but the whole idea of a high processor executing NOVA instructions, but the whole idea of the network and as the computer, or the computer as the network, which was a term coined by a company much later. And talking about starting with the Diablo printer, the laser printer was in the future, about cost of about $10,000, 2.5 megabyte disk, which is what these are. But it would be a test bed. These guys can elaborate on this much more, about looking at network computing. If you have your own computer with your own hard drive space, your own resources, but it is still networked. It's not a timeshare system. It's your own personal machine, but it's still tied into the network. What phenomena of work practice will emerge? What phenomena of play, of design will emerge in such a network? And talking about they're talking about it running Lisp, but I don't think it was meant to run Lisp, but they never did. Run this by now.
That's not true at all. I'll have a bit to say about that.
Thank you for that correction. So, the applications. It's a really great thing, and this is in honor of Butler and the vision of this team in the early 70s, and what it competes with. There's a piece of this computer called the Max upstairs too.
You should read item D.
Item D.
That's my favorite line.
The implications of Alpha for the local network are unclear. Oh, item E for the IMLEX fans. IMLEX are wiped out. So,
graphics terminals. Obsolete graphics terminals.
Of which Salam has two, I believe, in his...
They were obsolete on the day they were born.
Yeah, they were vector-based. So with that, I think what I like to do is get out of the way of the people who really had the history to sort of leave a. We have this Alto will roll back upstairs. You can come up and touch it, everything after the panel, and give your prayers that it will actually start up. And with that, what I'd like to do is allow each of the speakers to kind of introduce themselves, because I think that's the point. We want to find out about them. We want to find out about how they feel this machine impacted the world in which we live, because it's the tap root upon which, when you sit in front of one of these things and you do email and you bring up a document and you compose something, you share something with somebody over a ubiquitous network, that I think is the Alto's legacy. It's an immense legacy, and it's 30 years ago this year. And with that, I think we'll start with John, who was extremely helpful in getting this panel together, and thank you very much for being an inspiration to get this going. And so, John Ellenby, can you introduce yourself? And I think we have a mic that's here to catch the sound.
So I should talk to the mic and be in the light. I can't. Well, actually, I really shouldn't be here because I wasn't here for the birthday of the Alto. The Alto was born in 73, and I joined Xerox in 74. And I guess my credentials are that I'm kind of a stepfather of the Alto because I took over and did the Alto 2, which is the one that's been produced in fairly high volume. But when I arrived in Xerox, I was kind of marked as a manager immediately because I introduced myself to one of the secretaries and said, I've got you, you know, you're going to be looking after me. He said, no, I'm leaving. I said, well, why is that? Well, this jerk keeps on parking his bicycle against my cubicle, and I just can't stand it. So I said, well, I'll go talk with him about that, which I did, and he stopped doing that, so she stayed, and everybody said, hey, this guy's a manager. So we were very pleased about that. Anyway, when I arrived, there were about five Altos that were... I'm sorry? Oh, I'm sorry, Bill.
Is this mic on at all?
Does this amplify, or is this just recording? Yeah, I'm sorry. I'll see.
Tom, is this mic gone at all? Does it go anywhere?
Okay. I'll speak up. When I arrived in Xerox, there were five Altos. Mike Oldfield, who was the tech. I think it was Mike Oldfield. Overton. That's right, Mike Overton. Was wringing his hands and trying to keep them going. They had some problems because the memory cards were, there was no error correction, and there were a few other problems, including a power supply problem, which we thought we fixed when we did the Alto 2. And Jerry, you know, after this experience that I could actually solve problems with retaining secretaries, said, well, you know, could you look after building the other 25 that were asking the SDS, the computer company that Xerox had bought for $1 billion. We were asking SDS to build them in their Western Technology Center in El Segundo. And there's a lot of problems because they say they can't build them. So go see them. I had come from Ferranti Limited and Edinburgh University. I had two full-time jobs before I arrived. One was a computer science teacher at Edinburgh University, and the other one was designing the Argus 700. And the Argus 700, if any of you know about computer history, should know that it's probably one of the world's great multiprocessors. It was a mechanical marvel. And so I thought, well, maybe there's some mechanical problems here, and we'll sort those out. But the big deal was trying to get SDS to build these 25 machines. And it turned out they hated Park. SDS absolutely hated Park, and for good reason. We really stuck it to the bus. The Max, which was up on the screen as the one of the machines that Park had built, was actually a knockoff of the PDP-10. And the reason that Park went ahead and built its PDP-10 and called it Max, after Max Pileski, who was the founder of SDS, in other words, to really stick it to him, instead of buying something from SDS, Park wanted to build a PDP-10. The PDP-10 was not allowed to be bought because we owned SDS, and that was a competitor of digital equipment. So
Xerox,
sorry. And so Max, by the way, is the grandfather of the Alto, because we used all the Max cards. Chuck went ahead and built the Alto out of the Max cards. And so what
Chuck
you...
Chuck Thacker.
Chuck Thacker, I'm sorry. Chuck Thacker built the Alto 1 using the same form factor as those cards, and also used the same memory structure out of the Max. And while the memory and the Max worked fine because we could pay a lot of money to have screen parts, and those of you who remember semiconductors in the early days will know that solid-state memories were a little bit flaky, when we started to build Altos in significant quantities, it was quite a problem. So I not only got SGS to build these machines by being nice to them and saying, hey, you know, Max Pilatsky's a great guy, you know, I mean, he's SGS is a tremendous company. Then, of course, in the middle of this, Xerox went and tubed the whole computer division, and I had to sort of cling on to the guys who were building Altos. It was a pretty exciting time to do the Alto 2. I had the spec for the Alto 2, but basically the Alto 2 was a re-engineering of the Alto 1 so we could make them in volume. We had lots of excitement building them, and we had lots of excitement getting them out to customers all over Xerox. Some of them were on serialized numbers that we sent to various people to get favors done. And there were quite an amazing set of things that happened. But the most amazing thing that happened with the Alto was what exactly Butler was forecasting should happen, and that is that people like Charles here and Peter and
Dave,
I think, with Smalltalk later, but actually who came along as a student very early on, it was the fact that it was software that made the difference. This machine is all about software. You know, what really impressed me about the Alto when I first looked at it was it's a software machine. You know, I came from the Alto 700, which was all distributed multiprocessors, actually processors all over the world because we did airline systems and banking systems, and so it was a distributed system, very familiar to Bill English back there, because distributed versus share was one of the big deals. The Alto did everything with a microprocessor with a lot of microcode and did an incredible good job, but it was a software-driven machine. The microcode, the software, and of course WYSIWYG, Smalltalk, and Lisp, and all these other things that happened were extraordinary. The other great thing about the Alto, of course, is connectivity, the fact that we had a lot of them. I was hoping that we'd have John Schock here, not only because he did the first worm, but actually he's the first VC that did the first worm. So we could say, hey, you know, all VCs shouldn't say rude things like that. But the worm was an extraordinary thing because that was another example of connecting all these machines together and having them act in unison. Because what he did was to shove packets backwards and forward at night for his thesis. So the other big thing about the Alto, of course, was that it had to have printers. And because WYSIWYG, what you see is what you get, and here is Mr. What you see is what you get, in a very, very big sense, this is Bravo here, had to have a printer that could print to that quality. And so the laser printers that Gary Starkweather did, is he coming? He's not here, I realize that. But the laser printer was really the most important part, along with WYSIWYG, along with the software, along with the whole idea that many, many computers could be connected together regardless of where they were in the world. So it was a terribly exciting time. I was very grateful to be a part of it, very excited by it. If you like, I have some artifacts about the Alto 2 specs, the final decisions of Xerox to can the Alto, and what sort of led up to that, and also the letter that was written to me about why they were not going to do it, which was rather interesting and nice.
It wasn't meant to be a product.
Was not meant to be a product. And big lesson that I learned way, way back in my early days with Ferranti is that you never make your prototypes look nice. The prototype should be horrible. And then management will invest in tooling. So, you know, this thing should be spun all over the floor, should be dangerous, should actually, you know, spark and probably catch fire and be a real hazard. And then management will invest in tooling. And as it was, you know, that machine, the Alto 1 looks just like the Alto 2 in so many respects. It looked complete, it looked finished. And so why not build lots of these? But of course, there was no drawing package. You know, there was no attempt to make it maintainable. And so the Alto 2 did a little bit towards that, but we had in mind that we do the Alto 3, and then Butler, being the father of all this in many, many ways, had designed what we call the Wildflower, which was a single board personal computer, which is really a software-driven paradise machine, which of course is sort of now out there and has commonplace. So for all those reasons, I'm very pleased to be here. I hope I meet many of you, but I'm much more interested to hear what these guys say, because really it's software that made the machine. And of course, that's how it is today.
Let's move your mic.
thanks, John, and I'm very grateful for your recognition. And certainly the altar wouldn't have happened without your management techniques that were truly new to Park at the time, and they were truly necessary. So I'm Charles Simoni, and I got to Park because I worked at Berkeley Computer Corporation with Peter and Bartle Lampson and Chuck Thacker, and I was a student at Berkeley. Berkeley Computer Corporation went bankrupt, and Bob Taylor, who was working with the professors there at Berkeley Computer through ARPA, hired the whole bunch to start Park in a act of great foresight. And I was kind of a hanger-on, an undergraduate, still didn't have my undergraduate degree. In fact, I was a foreign student on an F-1 visa without a valid passport, on the edge of deportation, literally. And basically, I without a work permit. So much of the wizardry work was accomplished at quarter time, practically as an illegal alien. But fortunately, I had another quarter of my time was spent at the ILIAC 4 project. And if you go to the floor, you will see some pieces of the ILIAC 4, and they probably still have my thumbprints on the buttons on the console. And the ILIAC, of course, was also called the Vietnam of computer science. And it was a computer with so many bugs and so difficult to debug and so retro, it's unbelievable. But it accomplished a very important task, which is to prevent my deportation. So I'm very grateful. The moment I got my green card in 75, which was after the second version of Bravo, I had to call the ILIAC project and say that sorry, I got my green card, I'm out of here. So those were that was my access to Park, and it was indeed a wonderful place in many ways. And I just want to say one thing about the architecture that you described, and we saw Butler's memo, which is, I mean, it's an incredible document. It's so modern. It's one of those documents that are old in their age, but read in a completely modern way. And just to mention one example, the square pixels. The IBM PC, of course, started with non-square pixels, and it took them until 87 or 88 before they got onto square pixels. But I want to say something. I just want to say something different about that memo. Is that much remarkable? It is that memo was written by Butler. Butler, of course, was a software person and a theoretical genius. So it's not that surprising that he would have written something like that. I think what's incredibly surprising, and it's an outstanding performance, is the performance from Chuck Thacker. Namely, here we had an engineer who actually did it, did the architecture that was essentially a software architecture. And John, you were emphasizing the fact that the machine was software driven, which is very true. But I'd like to also rephrase that a little bit and say that it was a machine for the software. It was designed for the software. And probably for the first time, it introduced this concept, not explicitly, but implicitly, called separation of concerns, which now we in the industry, we really believe in that. And what I mean by that, you have to put yourself back to that era. Before the Alto, for example, the most popular terminal was the 3270 by IBM. And all of these hardware artifacts had many very aggressive engineers behind them who really wanted to make their hardware the best in the world, the most features, really help the user. So the hardware people would actually so-called study the user, look at the requirements, and then build the exact hardware that was that would answer those requirements. And that was, of course, in some sense, it makes sense. You know, it's like the central, it's the same nonsense as the idea of central planning. That, you know, the best way to do cars is that we have a committee and then we do the, we study people's needs and then we build a car that exactly meets people's needs. The problem is that the engineers were just too busy and doing everything wrong. They were spending too much time studying the users and didn't spend enough time on the resolution, on the how flat the screen is, how cheap the screen is, you know, when it can be color, new technologies of displaying things. So what the separation of concerns means is that Chuck Stecker said that I'm going to give you bits, and now everything is in your hands. Are you going to use it for Chinese characters? Are you going to use it for Cookie Monsters? Are you going to use it for justified text, for blinking text, for I don't know what? Basically, every configuration of bits on the screen was acceptable. And now the hardware guy can go away and make things better. And if we look, for example, just the display technology since then. By the way, the same thing is true for the keyboard. The keyboard was a non-decoded keyboard. You basically got bits from the keyboard saying the state of the particular keys. And that made it possible, for example, in Smalltalk to people to do keyboard, I mean, play music on the keyboard or reprogram the keys, use different shift keys. You could do basically anything you wanted because you didn't have to bag the hardware engineer that was really a very difficult person to. They always had these great arguments of why they can't do things, which were generally also true. So this step of Chuck Thacker saying, hey, I'm going to contribute by making things simpler, I think was instead of making things better, which was just a word. It really didn't make things better when the engineers said that they were making things better. So Chuck Thacker kind of stepping back and saying that things are going to be simpler. I'm going to make this really good, and John making it more reliable and more ubiquitous and less expensive. You know, the price curve had to go down when the numbers were going up. First we had build of 5, and then we build of about 50. Then the next build was 2,000. So that was very interesting. So that's one of the things, and I will say another short thing, but just Chuck Thacker's attitude to software, I think, was one of the greatest changes in this history. The other interesting turning point for me came was when I saw secretaries and spouses come in at night using the system, using computers. These, we are talking about civilians. I don't think anybody has ever seen civilians using computers on their own accord before. And people were, for example, Butler's wife, Lois, was doing her thesis at that time. This was in 74. At that time, when you wrote a PhD thesis, it wasn't biotech, by the way. It wasn't called biotech at the time, but it was immunology. So she was writing the thesis. When you started to write a PhD thesis, of course, the first thing you did was hire a typist. Am I? Do you remember that? So you hired a typist. She was doing her own thesis on a computer. Unbelievable. Spouses were coming in, writing PTA newsletters. Unbelievable. People self-publishing newsletters, 1974, 75. People were writing, of course, letters to home. Hey, mom, look, using all the different fonts, including black letter font, and we had a special font for the Xerox logo. So you had just X, you know, X-E-R-O in that font. because it was so big, there was no font scaling, so it had to be big, and, you know, the space was at a premium, so we only had those few letters. So this change from computers being a laboratory equipment that would break, that you could break. And people were still afraid of it. I remember people coming to me and said that Charles, I broke the machine. And I said, no, it's a bug, you know, let me go fix it. They said, and they showed me and they said, well, I must have broken it because every time I do such and such, it displays Chinese and it displays garbage. So obviously it's her action that caused the system to fail. And in some sense, they were right. But they felt guilty about breaking the machine because at that time, the idea of a computer that is a helpful appliance that didn't exist. I think that the mouse was fantastic. You know, people were predicting how civilians would never touch a mouse or would never acquire the motor skills that are necessary to do it. And of course, you know, it should be really light pens that should be used, and so on and so forth. But so let me tell you just 10 seconds about how WYSIWYG came about. We had a demo where we took, we printed the screen, which had a nice memo with multiple fonts and all that, and we printed it on the Dover, which is on the floor, and we printed it on a transparent stock, you know, the stock that you use for slides. That could be fed into a Xerox copier. So we fed the transparent stock, and we had the printout of the screen on transparent stock. And when his executives from Citibank came to visit and looked at the machine, and we printed it, and somebody went to the shared printer to pick up the output, and I held up the transparent stock in front of the screen to show that they are the same. In fact, they weren't the same at all because the resolution, but that's neither here nor there. They were roughly the same, plus I said it was the same. You know, the power of suggestion. The margins were the same, and the logo was the same, but the actual words were different because of the difference in resolution, which you wanted it to be that way, but you're not going to get into that. Because it's the same. And so one of the executives said, and remember, this was a time of Laffin and Flip Wilson, and Flip Wilson had this tagline had a character, a woman character, Geraldine, that's right, and the tagline was, what you see is what you get. And so this executive said, I see, you know, what you see is what you get. I said, yeah, sure. you know, you are from Citibank. I said, you bet. You know, displaying my newly acquired vocabulary. So, you bet. Yes, sir. So that's how that happened. With the story about the last memo, I was asked about that. I know that the memo said that this machine wasn't meant to be a product. So I kind of commented to the writer of a book about that, saying that Xerox would have, if they would have found gold at Southermill, they would have said that this place is not meant, wasn't meant to be a gold mine. I think we should build some condominiums here. So
what was the date of that memo?
78, I believe, but yeah. you probably remember it better. So by 79, I started to look for a job, and in 80, I met this young kid called Bill Gates, and then we kind of went on from there. So thank you.
John has the answer to date.
Next is Peter Deutsch, who will do a fine job.
This is the final kiss-off.
Oh my God! I want to see
this. So I'm L. Peter Deutsch, not to be confused with Peter J. Deutsch. And ironically, the thing that most people probably know my name for these days has absolutely nothing to do with Park, at all, except very, very indirectly, which is that I'm the author of Ghost Script. But today I'm not going to talk about Ghost Script. Instead, I'm going to do something that I enjoyed doing very much at Park and have tried to do whenever I can since then, which is to take a large view and stir up a little bit of controversy. because I have opinions about lots of things.
And some of them are wrong.
And some of them are wrong. There's a little poem by, I think it's a Danish poet, and the last, I don't remember, it's kind of a limerick. Piet Hein, right? And the last two lines are air and air and air again, but less and less and less. So I think that's the best we can hope for in life. So it's wonderful that, John said the Alto is or was a software machine. And Charles said the Alto was designed for the software. And I'm going to return to that point. I have some things to say about it kind of independently from a different point of view. But what I'd really like to do, I'm not going to tell, reminiscences or stories, except I'm going to tell one which I just can't resist, and it's about Charles. My first distinct memory of Charles is when he was, this wet behind the ears undergraduate age student. And the little conversation that sticks in my mind was when Charles was saying, in the course of a discussion, I want to make a lot of money because what I want to do is go and hire a language coach and learn to speak English with a really good accent. I've never forgotten that.
Well, that's great. Actually, I have done it.
Uh-huh.
The language coach, that is, and in fact, he taught me my R's. I now have American R's before I had Hungarian R's.
Hungarian R's.
So, but as I say, what I'd like to do right now is to kind of take the large view, and I'd like to talk a little bit about what I think made the Alto interesting, partly in retrospect, partly at the time. So I think there were three technical things that, from my point of view as a software developer and as primarily kind of a languages and systems guy, that made the Alto interesting. The first one was the bitmap display. As Charles pointed out, in 1970, the context was that the only kinds of displays that you saw were very, very limited function character grid terminals and very expensive vector displays. The decision to make a bitmap display, I agree with Charles fully. It was revolutionary. It was way ahead of its time. And at the time, it was also a decision that drove the cost of the Alto way up. As Butler's memo said, half the cost of the Alto was the RAM. And in the original 96K byte design for the Alto, 64K bytes of that was the bitmap for the screen.
It was variable size, which was a good decision.
In the hardware context of the time, that was a good decision. The bitmap display refreshed out of main memory. And if you had a full screen being displayed, the display actually sucked up a large fraction of the processor and memory cycles, I think about 70% if I remember right. And so, for example, when the machine was doing something compute intensive, it was actually very important to blank the screen.
Or part of it.
It
actually ended up
yeah. Right. So you wanted to have
right.
status for
right, something. Exactly. What shifted since then, and the Alto was way, way ahead of the curve, was that the costs of that RAM has become much, much cheaper, and just as important, CPUs have become faster so that they can do the things that you kind of needed, or that we had thought that you might need specialized hardware to do at the time. So that was the first thing, was the bitmap display. Ahead of its time, a clear winner, but it was a clear winner because of this thing that happened in hardware. You can say that there was kind of a feedback loop effect here. I'm not going to speculate about that. The second thing that was really interesting about the Alto was the fact that the machine was microcoded. Only very unusual specialized machines were used microcode as their execution strategy. And I guess some large machines might have used it internally as an implementation method. But the idea that the execution of the machine would be based on writable microcode, loadable microcode, used to emulate instruction sets in a programmable way, that was also a very unusual decision. It was done for flexibility. And I have to say that we, in my opinion, squandered most of that opportunity. Because we used, what we would do is, when you wanted to run a program, the microcode got loaded up with an instruction set emulator for, you know, whichever of the two or three instruction sets that program wanted to do. This was, in some respects, a really lousy use of microcode. The thing that would have made microcode really revolutionary would have been for it to be used to implement higher-level functions and to be dynamically loadable. By compiling or handwriting algorithms into microcode and loading them into the microstore, you would have gotten about an order of magnitude improvement in performance. And in fact, there were two really stellar examples where we did do that, and it, I think, arguably, in one case, changed the world. And that instance was BigBlit. Today it's called Rasterop. If I'm not mistaken, Dan Ingles was the one who wrote the alpha microcode for BigBlit. And having Rasterop, having BigBlit there as a primitive, as a high-speed, high-performance primitive that programs could draw on, completely changed the way that you thought about what you could do fast enough with a bitmap-based display. And BigBlit, it was only possible for BigBlit to do that because it could be implemented in microcode. The other example is one that I actually participated in. There was a company, I believe they might have been a part of Xerox. I don't remember any of the names, which is a good thing. They had built a special purpose engine for doing high speed sequential pattern matching in text databases. And they said, well, look, you know, traditional databases, you have to have all these indexes, and you have to have very complicated software, and so forth, and so on. And it would be of tremendous value if you could simply, you know, do full, you know, full text, full data linear searches in an affordable amount of time. And we've built this special purpose piece of hardware that will allow you to search a database basically as fast as you can haul the data off a disk. No, I'm not sure I should say the name of this project because it was an internal project at the company, and for reasons that will become clear in a moment, you probably wouldn't have heard it. So somehow word of this came to Park, and somehow, I don't remember how any longer, I was put on I was basically made the technical half of a team to go to where this was being developed and evaluate it. So I went there, you know, and I listened to the researchers, you know, they described what this piece of hardware could do, and they gave me the performance figures. And I thanked them. And then I took those performance figures back home, and on the plane going back home, I thought very hard. And I said, you know, if one wants to do a sequential search of this kind at the speed of this disk, one can take the search pattern, compile it into tailored microcode, and the microcode can then do the same search faster than the dedicated hardware. I got back to Park. I implemented that idea. I actually wrote the compiler. I think I may have actually had to write a dynamic microcode loader. But at any rate, it was demonstrable. And you know, I wrote the memo that says you don't need special purpose hardware to do this, and the project was killed. So this is just to illustrate that we really didn't come anywhere near exploiting the potential that we had so wonderfully designed into the Alto and its successor, the Dorado.
We did use it for Daimler.
Yes, I don't know about.
Was the company in Pasadena?
I don't know where the headquarters of the company were. The place that I went was not Pasadena. And then there was a then there was a third thing that I think was somewhat revolutionary from a technological point of view. And I mean, revolutionary, no, that's a little too strong, because people had been doing this beforehand, but it was a decision that I think was somewhat unusual at the time, which was the decision to do essentially all the systems programming in a higher level language. We did the programming in a language called BCPL, which was from today's vantage point, a predecessor of C. And in retrospect,
that... We call it C minus minus.
C flat, perhaps.
He's taking music theory courses.
Yes, I retired last year as a software developer, and I'm now embarking on a new career as a musician.
And there is this language called C sharp, so which is Microsoft's flagship language. So it's a very good point.
So those are the three things that, from my point of view, as a kind of a languages and systems software guy, were really remarkable about the Alto and opened up new vistas and enabled a lot of great creative work at Park in the 70s and 80s. Now I want to talk a little bit about why I think the Alto was really interesting in a couple of non-technical respects. And this came out clearly in Butler's memo, which of course scrolled right by the screen, but are there printed copies, or is there something that, can
on
people
the,
read it?
The DigiBarn website.
Okay, great. It has to do with the idea of personal computing. Now, I mean, that phrase is a cliche these days. But at the time, it meant, it had a lot more freshness to it, because the by and large, the image of computing at that time was, I mean, aside from a few very expensive research installations, was either a terminals attached to a time-sharing system, or a mainframe computer being used in batch mode. So the idea that a person, that an individual, a civilian, great word, Charles, could have ownership of his or her own computing resources was really quite a remarkable idea. This was the very early 1970s. A number of us had gone to Berkeley. On some of us, it rubbed off. And so if I might say that some of us were thinking, power to the user. I mean, I'm smiling, but that was really the way we felt about this, that the Alto represented a paradigm shift in control, ownership, access to computing resources. And again, the Alto was way ahead of the curve in terms of making that affordable in terms of dollars. Way ahead of the curve.
And usable.
Right. It was also way ahead of the curve in usability.
In some ways, I think usability was more realistic than affordability, because $50,000, $50,072 is not exactly affordable. It was affordable for Xerox.
Right.
But for example, when Butler took one home, that was a big event. I mean, to talk about paradigm shift, when we got our own machine, that was incredible. But then when one of the guys actually took one home, so I think he had two. That was unbelievable. That created quite a stir, and isn't that right?
It is right.
So we weren't quite as liberated as we could have been.
Well, no,
except for Alan Kay, who said, think of them as...
All I remember was Alan's statement.
Kleenex.
As Kleenex, right. Yeah. Right. The little bon mot of Alan's that I remember right now is the one that said, I think this was Alan who said, someday computers will be so cheap that they'll give them away as prizes in cereal boxes. Was that Alan?
It could have been. I remember the Kleenex. So, think of them as Kleenex. Right. You use them and then throw them away.
So the interesting thing is that we are in some ways seeing that I think we're on the leading edge of seeing that trend reversed. I mean, we all have computer equipment in our homes, or many of us do. Probably everyone here does. But in terms of ownership and control of that computing resource, we have the vendor self-help provisions of USITA. We have the license verification provisions of TCPA. We have stealthware that applications install on our machines. So it's kind of interesting that even though we now have ownership of our computing resources, it's not clear that we're not about to start losing some control. And if you don't know what those acronyms mean, this isn't the time or place for me to have the discussion about them. That's another very, very long discussion. The other thing that I want to say on the subject of ownership and control of one's own computing resources has to do with the kind of the evolution of the World Wide Web. As many of you probably know, the web originated because, or at least the legend is, that a bunch of physicists in Europe wanted to have a way to publish results for each other, to each other. So the origins of the web are very much in individual origination of content, individual publishing. The direction that the web has gone has been very much back towards a consumer-producer paradigm. Now, there are a lot of people, you know, doing their own web pages, and yet your ability to work with the material that gets presented to you on the web is very limited. So, for example, facilities for, just to take an example, block pop-ups to prevent systems. There are web pages that can prevent you from going back. There are many things, harmful content that is, stealth executables. Technology for that has lagged far behind the development of the web, and aside from technology to block actual harmful content is evolving much, much more slowly. I'd like to be able to reshape, to aggregate, to select, to reorder. I'd like to be able to do sort of publishing-like transformations on the material that comes to me over the web. Very little work that I know of has been done on that. You know, maybe there's work I don't know about, but I don't see it. And so I think, in that respect, the promise of the web, and in its ancestry back to the idea of individual control of computer resources, is not being realized well. And this brings me to the other half of the Alpha legacy. I talked about personal computing a moment ago. Another phrase that we heard later, after the Ethernet became, kind of more a part of our lives at Park, was interpersonal computing. So that's a phrase that you hardly hear at all anymore, if at all. And in fact, my recollection is that aside from Maze War, that most of the use of the Ethernet from the Alto at Park was for what today we would call access to services or access to servers. File transfer, printing, email. Am I forgetting something important?
The Sims? I mean, the electronic games, the electronic arts, the Sims games?
Right, but I'm referring to things from the Alto era.
Well, there was maybe this is a little after Alto.
That's the same as Maze War. You covered that.
Bob Stoltz's media space stuff was about doing architectural type design
collaboratively.
Collaborative.
Yes, that was substantially later than the era that I'm thinking about.
I think Office Talk, we tried with Office Talk to bring out simultaneous screens that were shared throughout the enterprise, and the ones that went into the Santa Clara branch here, where Altos were delivered to Shelby Carter's group.
Right.
They had Office Talk, which had simultaneous screens.
In the CoLab meeting.
Right.
There was a demo version of multiple user SIL that was done for Boca Raton in '77, but it never went beyond.
Yes. Okay, so this kind of, you know, this I think this does kind of support my point that the interpersonal aspect of the Alto, what today we would call, you know, collaborative or peer-to-peer computing, despite the fact that the hardware was there and that the bottom levels, the bottom layers of the networking software were certainly there, was also very, very much under-realized.
Well, I think that continues to this day. Collaborative meeting software is still way behind the curve of everything else in computing.
Not only collaborative meeting software is behind the curve, but what we would call peer-to-peer or non-centralized use of the network is lagging. And again, there are other forces, most recently the RIAA, that are pushing back against that, in my opinion, pushing back against that developing.
Online chat rooms is an exception.
Except, as you know, Microsoft recently shut down practically all of their chat rooms outside the U.S. So
not for technical reasons.
I understand that, but that's my point. It's non-technical forces that are some of these that work. Instant messaging. Yes, great example. Great example.
Within business, trust has been a big problem.
Right, right. There are lots of reasons. I'm you know, trying to say, you know, this is what I see. So, I did want to respond to the comment about running Lisp on the Alto. I've covered all five of the points I wanted to make, but I wanted to mention Alto Lisp. There was a Lisp on the Alto. I wrote most of the microcode, or at least the early microcode, and I did kind of the system design. And it was kind of a tour de force. I mean, it's sort of like a dog walking on its hind legs. It doesn't do it very well, but it's remarkable that it can do it at all. So we were able to run Lisp on the Alto. We were able to run large, sophisticated inter-Lisp programs if you were on time dilation drugs. Because the Alto didn't have anywhere near enough memory to run, you know, the kind of large Lisp systems that people were running on the PDP-10. And the other thing is that, you know, I talked about using Alto microcode to emulate instruction sets. Bytecoded instruction sets, compressed instruction sets, were very important in those days because RAM was so expensive. And so emulating compressed instruction sets was a very important implementation technique. That's what we did for Lisp. And it's especially important in a language whose finest grained primitives don't match the machine's natural instruction set very well, match the machine's natural hardware very well. That was also the case for Lisp. You know, in the simplest operations, you know, car, cutter, numeric comparison, you have to do type checks. And if we tried to compile Lisp into sort of the natural native instruction set of the machine, which was the Nova instruction set, which you can think of, you know, it's sort of like a, you know, like an 8086 that's been run over by a tractor several times. It would have been awful. You know, it would have taken dozens and dozens of instructions to do just one simple primitive operation. So from that point of view, emulating a bytecoded instruction set was a really good deal. But of course it did it much faster than you could emulate bytecodes in software. But in retrospect, it just wasn't a good implementation technique. As a Bitblit example, the database search example also show, as a gross oversimplification, software will beat hardware most of the time. Because for software, you can compile. That is, you can use non-local knowledge to affect how something is implemented. Hardware is inherently interpretive. Well, I've kind of rambled on. I'm sure I haven't told nearly enough of the anecdotes that everybody would like to hear. But this is kind of my perspective on the Alto from a 30-year vantage point. Thank you.
Well, my name is Dave Robson. I'm kind of the interloper here. I was kind of a kid in this candy store back in the early 70s. And it was an honor and a privilege for me to get to work with such luminaries as we have here. I did get to know the Alto fairly intimately. I spent a long time microcoding it, and so you get to know the inner workings and the foibles of it that way. But I was mainly a software guy. I went to work for Alan Kay and Dan Ingalls on the Smalltalk project and spent 10 or 12 years doing that. And the Alto was, of course, a key enabler for a lot of that work. But I was not a hardware guy in any stretch of the imagination. When I thought about doing this, when I was asked to do this, I went down in the basement to look for things that I might have had squirreled away, and found a variety of interesting things. And among them were what I think of as sort of the top end and the bottom end of looking at the Alto. From the bottom was an early copy of what's called a personal computer system. And this one, it just had Chuck Thacker and Ed McCright's name on it. Eventually, it got published with Butler's name and a variety of other names, maybe even some of these guys. It basically describes the machine itself, the architecture of the machine, how the microcode runs the processor, and the basic I/O devices. And then at the top end was this thing called personal dynamic media. So interesting that personal actually comes in on both ends. I agree with Peter that was one of the key things about it. This was mainly written by Alan Kay. It's got the Learning Research Group as the author, and Dan and Adele Goldberg and several of the other people helped Alan write this. But this was Alan's kind of vision of computing. And he talks not so much about whether you ought to use microcode or whether you have drivers for the display or use microcode for that or any of that thing, but he talks about what he sees for computing in the future. And his basic idea, well, personal dynamic media, actually all of those kind of figure. But personal was a key one, and he said if you just look at and you extrapolate out what's happening on the hardware end of the world with software, with memory, processors,
displays.
Well, displays were a little bit of a problem, right? Because memories and processors were on the what you call it curve.
They were
on the curve. But
Alan predicted that we would have a PDP-10 on our lap with a flat display, and I thought he was crazy.
That's right.
And of course, we have like 200 PDP-10s on our laps, but with a flat display.
He's still crazy.
So, I have to be really careful here to not get into arguments with these guys because they're all smarter than I am. But
agreeing with you.
Yes. So Alan was Alan said even for five or 10 years before the Alto was first built, that in fact you could extrapolate out a good part of computer hardware, and that where you wound up is in sometime in the 80s you would have multiple PDP-10s that were the size of a notebook and that were cost in the thousands of dollars.
And by the way, by a notebook he meant a book like this, not a notebook computer.
Although that's roughly the size of.
Yes, I know, but it sounds funny when you say, because today when somebody says, I lost my notebook,
yes,
they locked the notebook computer. Right. At that time, it was this thing.
And so the two things that weren't on the curve, which were a problem with, and Alan called this the Dynabook. And so essentially this personal dynamic media is about the Dynabook. And one of the things that these things got called was the interim Dynabook. Because obviously this is a somewhat bigger than a notebook, and it wound up costing more than a few thousand dollars. It cost more than it was supposed to, but nonetheless, it had many of the characteristics of being very flexible. that Alan was envisioning for the kind of ability to interact with information and being personal. And so this was kind of an interim dynabook. The two things, and in fact, part of the problem with this was there were two problems with it. One of them was that we hadn't gone far enough down the curve to get the processor and the memory in the size of a notebook, although he was convinced that that was going to happen, and obviously he was right. The second one was there were two problems with the Dynabook Vision. One was the display, and the other was the battery. And neither one of those were on these kind of, you know, just wait another year and it'll get half the size and cost half the amount and be twice as powerful. But eventually, as he predicted, flat panel displays materialized, and batteries became good enough to get you at least on a transcontinental flight to be able to continue to use the thing. And so from that perspective, he turned out to be right. The important thing back in the Alto days was that this vision of what was going to happen in the future, and in particular, that people would own, that civilians would own computers and use them for their own purposes, was one of the things that drove much of the kind of vision of what we would do with these things. So so I came there to help with this small talk language environment. And one of the, I think the reason that I got hired actually was I was in college and I went on a visit to Park. And they graciously showed me around, and I talked to Alan for a little while, and then talked to Dan Ingles for longer, and asked him a lot of questions about the inner workings of Smalltalk, the software, and eventually I asked him a question. I said, well, why, you know, if objects, Smalltalk was an early object-oriented language, and if objects are so important, and classes are the way that programmers describe objects, then why aren't classes themselves represented as objects? And they thought that was a good question, so they hired me for the summer and told me to do it. And in the course of doing that, I showed some facility for microcoding this somewhat arcane machine, and so they kept me on to do that. And if I were going to argue with Peter, I would ask him why he wouldn't consider Bitblit just an extension of the instruction set.
Well, it was an extension of the instruction set, but the point is that it accelerated a higher level algorithm in a way that made a qualitative difference in how you think about that algorithm. And I'll give you another example of it, which is much more mundane, and that's floating point. In the early days, floating point was done entirely in software, and it was slow and it was expensive. And people had to think two and three times before, and people still put a lot of work into doing their numerical work with fixed point if they could, because floating point was too expensive. Once floating point, once this higher level algorithm attained performance on a par with the other things that you thought of as primitives, it gave you a revolutionary change.
Okay, and but the difference between that and your search example is that it doesn't necessarily depend on dynamically loading the microcode.
Correct.
Right. Okay.
Correct.
So there yes, are.
I'm sorry, I didn't make that distinction well enough.
And you don't trust the hardware people to design it. That's the key thing.
Yeah.
There was another example that I think is very appropriate to this, particularly for Xerox, and that was the first peripheral that was built for the Alto, which was the Orbit, which generation of scan lines for a laser printer in microcode. And before that was available, if we wanted to do laser printing, we had to make up a bitmap ahead of time by a program that was called Press, and that took minutes to do. And when the Orbit came out, it could keep up with a laser printer. And it was one of these things that, to repeat Peter's phrase, changed the world, literally, because it made laser printing possible.
Yeah, the Dover cost about $500,000.
No. Ears cost about $500,000.
Ears, okay. Well, the thing that printed, okay. You are correct. the thing that printed cost $500,000.
Well, that's because the ears actually had custom electronics.
Oh, excellent.
Orbit was in the alpha.
You have to come up with $500,000 if you wanted to print.
But the point here is the transformation, and this is
what John was
alluding to. Is we, the first laser printer was called Ayers. It was a huge, not only hardware in the printing sense, but hardware in the electronic sense engine, full of specialized hardware. We blew that away, all that specialized electronics, with four boards that went in the Alto and special microcode, and that is the electronics which enabled the Dover, which you have upstairs, which is has almost no electronics in it. It's just the laser engine.
And it's only $250,000.
No, no, they were about 15.
They were 15,000.
They were very cheap.
So if I was going to say something like Peter did, in terms of what's the high level my high-level feeling about what makes the Alto kind of unique and special, it's that at the very high level, it was a very simple and flexible thing. The bitmap display was much more flexible than other displays. The sort of simplicity of the user interaction with it and the flexibility of the user interaction with it. And so at the level where you don't know anything about what's inside it, it's a beautifully simple and flexible machine. And at the very lowest level, it was also a very simple, uniform, beautiful machine. And to connect those two, there was actually a whole lot of complication that went into what you actually put in this very simple microcoded engine in order to make it drive the display and such. But it was really, in many regards, simplicity itself. I mean, the microcode had a few bells and whistles that were never quite beautiful and simple, but you learn to deal with those. So let me I'll finish here with just a couple of anecdotes. One of them is my Charles Simone story. I think this was you. The Xerox, of course, is. I guess one of the distinctions I have is I'm the only one of these folks who still work for Xerox. But Xerox has come in for a lot of second guessing in terms of what happened to the Alto that was developed at Park. And certainly there were some people who worked at Xerox who didn't quite understand what went on with the Alto and what went on at Park. And on the other hand, there were many who did, and Xerox has obviously continued to be a quite successful company, and some reasonable part of that success can be traced back to a variety of the work that was done by the people at Park and the people on the Alto. Not directly in terms of selling personal computers, but certainly in terms of the underpinnings of their business. And so there were a variety of the Xerox executives that did understand what they had and gave a good run at capitalizing on it. One of the folks that I don't think understood what was going on was there was a famous first visit by Xerox executives to Park after they had sort of set it up and let it get running for a while before they came in from the east. So they came in, did a bunch of demos, went away. And one of them back at corporate headquarters, the story was his secretary said, well, we've heard about this research lab out in Palo Alto. It's really, they're doing interesting and exciting things. Did you see anything, was it really neat? And he says, yeah, it was amazing. It was incredible. And she says, well, what'd you see? He says, I saw a man who can type faster than you. Oh, is that you? You're not a fast typist? Okay. I had always heard it was Charles, but I guess Charles is not a fast typist.
It was Warren, probably.
Warren.
Maybe, okay.
Warren.
It was Warren.
Okay.
And then one other story that has a little bit more to do with this, it has to do with the worm and the memory tester and what you could do with these things. Dick Shoup was one of the other people in Alan Kay's learning research group, and He was did a lot of pioneering work in color graphics. There, I had the privilege of sharing an office for many years with his color system, and there was a single color Alto in the building because at that time, because it required this huge special color bitmap to go along with it to drive the display. Well, yes, but Albie worked with Dick Shelp. Okay. Dick, in fact, eventually got an Emmy, and I think Park actually got an Emmy as well, for the basic technology that underlies the weather reports on the news. The first widespread application of this was the ability to show what we think of as how you get how you find out what the weather looks like when you turn on the TV. But Dick was very interested in a whole variety of things, including mathematics. And there was a guy, Cambridge University mathematics professor named G. Spencer Brown, who'd written an interesting book called Laws of Form back in the 60s on a derivation of arithmetic from first principles. Dick was very interested in that. Spencer Brown was at Stanford for a year on a sabbatical. And so Dick invited him over to Park to give a talk. And at the end of the talk, Dick had something else he had to do for half an hour, 45 minutes before lunch, and he asked me if I would give him a tour of the building, which is always a challenge because, you know, it was a building full of offices, and there was, you know, paper on the desks, but there wasn't anything particularly thrilling to look at. But
beanbags,
yeah, that was one of the good stuff. So I gave him a tour of the building and showed him around, and we gotten maybe halfway around the building when he said, Dave, this is all very interesting. He says, but what are those things that are under the desks? And I thought, I no longer thought that much about them, and I thought, well, I thought of the machine as mainly my interface with it, the display and the keyboard. But of course, that wasn't all that unusual. You go to a research lab or a university department at the time, and there would be displays and keyboards, but there wouldn't be anything under the desk. And so I said, well, those are the computers. And he says, what do you mean those are the computers? I said, well, each of the displays is hooked to a individual computer, and that's sort of what we're working on here is what does it mean when everybody's got their own computer? And he thought for a while, his eyes got really big, and he says, what do they do at night? And so being a mathematician, and particularly being a number theorist who was interested in prime numbers, he had spent a good part of his career scrounging for cycles on mainframe computers at night. And so he was a real kid in a candy store. And so I said, I answered his question, and what they do at night, or what they did do at night, was test their own memory. Because the memory was so notoriously bad that they would just run a program, which I think probably just wrote and read and saw if what they read was the same thing as they wrote, and kept a record when they were different. So Spencer Brown
and reported it over the net.
Yes.
That's the
eventually, not at first. Not at first.
Yeah, right away.
Right away.
No. In the early versions, it didn't use the net. You had to go in and look at it.
Okay, that was just Alpha 1.
Yes.
Okay. Actually, Alpha 2 is error correction.
Yes, that's right. This was
still reported.
This was an Alpha 1.
So they actually got some very good data for the manufacturers of the memory.
So we did two things to help him investigate prime pairs in the early gazillions. One of them was he needed to be able to do division of arbitrary size numbers. And so Dan Ingalls had already implemented Don Knuth's arbitrary precision arithmetic package. He'd done the easy part, which is addition, subtraction, and multiplication. and so I spent a month or so implementing the division, which is more important to the primality checks. And then the second thing we did was took John Schock's Ethernet worm and used it to parcel out pieces of these huge programs that would test lots and lots of numbers by dividing them by other numbers and then report the answers back. And so there was a period of some number of months where almost all of Park was consumed with this huge mathematical task of multiplying and dividing large numbers. And again, an example of the kind of flexibility that that the whole system provided to do things that had never been done before.
Dave. Another example of the flexibility of the design of the Alto was very early on Park, there was a joint project between Park and Fujitsu, headed by Bill English,
right,
that did a Japanese word processor, WYSIWYG word processor on the Alto, where there was not enough real memory for one 10-point display buffer. And they did the WYSIWYG editor, the swappy punched off the disk, and that the flexibility of the Alto allowed that. That was really the genesis of the whole internationalization and the genesis of Unicode. So directly from the flexibility of the architecture. Mm-hmm. But there's not an English computing system, really, I think.
Yep. And so I guess the one last point I would make is that, you know, I think that it's truly remarkable how much of the kind of vision of the future from personal dynamic media and the sort of Dynabook vision actually happened, that people, in fact, carry around civilians, as a matter of course, carry around these things that, that make a PDP-10 look pedestrian and use them for their own personal use that doesn't have anything to do with being a computer scientist. So that actually came through. The one thing that that didn't really come through is that although Alan, I think, certainly predicted that not everyone would be a computer programmer, I think he thought that people would, that the users of these things would modify the functionality in ways that they, it turns out that most users don't. So most users wouldn't know the difference whether this was a thing that was, you know, implemented in electronics that was non-flexible, other than the fact that, of course, they can load a new program very easily.
But unless you think that Excel, for example, is a way of working and modifying the behavior.
Absolutely, and these days that's most of the programming that I get to do.
But let me just add one thing which has to do with this panel, since we are talking about notebooks. Do people realize that who created the company that created the first notebook computer? It's John Allenby, sitting right here, started Grid Computer, that was the first. Well, notebook form factor,
laptop
computer.
Yep.
What we're going to do now is, as we organically segue into questions, just a couple of announcements before that. I think we're going to do questions and answers for about 30 minutes, and then in about an hour upstairs in the hall, which is now open, the exhibit hall, we're going to have a nice Alto birthday cake and a kind of celebration of the 30th, once we get the little chump back upstairs. And you can come by. It'll be in the room in the back, and you can see all the wonderful Xerox D machines that derived out of the Alto, including, well, not D machine, the stuff I wrote in the mid-80s. It looks like a star, but runs on the PC. It's kind of odd thing, called Elixir, written in high-level language and weird stuff like that. And Salam has an announcement.
I just have a couple announcements I wanted to make. When you're done here, you guys can go on as long as you want. I know you're having a lot of good fun, so this is just, you're welcome to stay here as long as you want, as long as these guys are willing to take all the questions, of course. And we have refreshments after you're done in the downstairs area, just beyond the stairs over here in the kind of refreshment lobby. They're provided by a friend of mine, Roger Sinison, who has a business called Tech Synthesis, and he's done a really great job of bringing out all kinds of refreshments in there. Complimentary, he has suggested donations if you want to help pay for the cost, but he provided everything. So they're there for you. Also upstairs, as Bruce mentioned, the exhibit hall is open now, and there's all kinds of craziness going on up there, so you'll want to adjourn up there when you're done. Definitely be there, let's say, after... let's say at about like 3:30, because it's 2:40 right now, we'll have the little birthday ceremony. And then also, if you were interested in the RetroCode game programming challenge, we're going to start that right now. And so if you wanted to be on one of the teams, we're assembling an Apple team, and we still need people for the Apple team. We have one person on the Atari team, and we have some people for the Commodore team. So we need some Apple people. And if you're not aware of it, the RetroCode challenge is we have an Apple IIe, a Commodore 64, an Atari 800, and we're trying to assemble three teams, and they're all going to compete. You're going to have 3 hours to write, to design and write a video game from scratch. And the at the end of that 3 hours, you stop. There's a drop-dead deadline. You have to stop, and then you demonstrate the game that you've come up with, and the best team will win some cash and some prizes and things like that. So if you want to be involved in that, you're going to have to leave here right now and come on up, because we need to start that right away. And that's it. I'll turn it back over to Bruce.
Last thing, I see that a lot of wonderful people were collecting signatures in this particular 10-year first companion decade of research at PARC to try to get as many signatures as we can in this book just for history. So if any of your PARC people, or even people, devotees of PARC for Zeroids, as the term was, please come and add your name to this so we can put this in our time capsule. And Q&A. You had something to say, John, before we start.
Yeah, I think one of the really fundamental things that we did right was to get lots and lots of machines out to programmers, but we also got a lot of machines out amongst the Xerox community in a very, very big way. And in fact, I did allude to some of the unserialized alphas that existed. We actually managed to get quite a number of alphas into the hands of secretaries of vice presidents and administrative assistants of vice presidents. And this actually had a lot of pull. Many, many people didn't realize that the Alto was an office product. So we have to get laser printers out there as well. So we've built a lot of Dover laser printers, and they were quite inexpensive because they were made out of remanufactured Xerox 7000. We tore out the optics and stuck in a laser slot head, and magic electronics of Orbit, which I think was quite fundamental. But to get them out into not just the programming community, which is hugely important, because that led to all of this creativity, but to get them out into real, just administrative office environments. We didn't succeed in getting as many out there as I like. We did build a lot of unserialized outlets. And by the way, this is credited with this is possibly why the Alto has this image of being expensive, because we actually didn't bill them to anybody. So this was a kind of freebie that we did. We had all kinds of allies all over the company. Amazing people helped all of this happen. Shelby Carter, I think, is one of the most extraordinary names that the company had as a huge supporter. And of course, Jack Goldman, who founded PARC, and supported us and looked after us and ran air cover for us. And the Alto 2, which of course is what this baby over here is, was sponsored by Dave Liddell, and I'm sorry that he's not here as well. But the most important thing, going back to what I said about prototypes, is the first one you do should be terrible and ugly, and then you should build lots and lots and lots of the second one. And that's really what this is all about. And the fact that they didn't take it to a product, it's kind of a shame, but that's because Xerox is getting eaten alive in the copy of duplicator base. In other words, its heartland was being attacked. It really couldn't get the attention span to go after this thing. And I just want to give you a slight story. That is that a journalist was probing me for he was an author. He was probing me. He said, Xerox didn't have any bulls, did they? And I said, well, that's true. One of the really interesting things about the company was that they wanted to be an office product, and they realized that the golf ball typewriter was the big thing, and they found that they couldn't license it, so they couldn't get any bulls. And from there, I suddenly realized that one of the things that we had, the big problem of getting the Alto accepted, was OSD, which was in Dallas. Their job was making daisy wheel printers. And so because they couldn't get you know, the golf ball typewriter, Xerox got very focused on the low-end printer. The thing that you had to have in the office was this daisy wheel printer, which had wonderful attributes, one of which was that it would actually, the daisy wheel, if anybody knows this, would actually fly apart because certain, you know, it flexed a little plastic wheel, you know, that went around. And sometimes, you know, there's words that are, that have letters in that are quite frequently used, or, and these are the ones that would break off. And it turned out that that solving that problem was a very, very big thing for OSD. And the Alto came along at just the time that they were trying to launch this word processor that was based on the daisy wheel printer, and had this big box with a, if you can believe it, a cassette tape that you stuck in there, which was your memory.
They had a MagCard version.
They also had a MagCard version, you're right. But the company was trying to do that. So long, long time ago, I said, well, yeah, it's true, Xerox didn't have any bulls, but they went off with the daisies. And really, if you look at what the company was trying to do, which was to have real low-end, low-cost products, the Alto was really fighting the war at that time. But I think it's, in you know, hindsight, we were destined to lose. But I think they could have stayed the course, and obviously the D machines and others could have been way, way lower cost and much more personal than they actually ended up being.
But you want to say
don't blame Xerox for not civilizing these things, is what I'm saying.
By all means, do blame Xerox. this story that how, you know, it's all explainable and there are these great arguments and great excuses from their vantage point. Come on. Other people.
I blame the daisy wheel printer. You see.
Earlier, it was said that there were all these. There are lots of people at Xerox that didn't understand it, and there were lots of people at Xerox who did understand it. Unfortunately, when you weight those numbers, I agree with those numbers. Fortunately, if you weight those numbers with the position the person occupied in the company, you will find a completely lopsided. Number, namely that most of the not understanding was highly weighted, and the understanding was weighted essentially at zero. So, but numerically, you are correct. One thing I'd just like to mention quickly that we distributed the machines to Washington D.C. and your machines were running in the Congress, in the Supreme Court, and the Executive Office of the President, as well as in Sweden, which was also interesting from the point of view of internationalization and localization techniques that were really pioneered there. Of course, with the end of the Carter administration, these machines were about to be thrown out until what one capability machines had was the ability to print in large fonts. And President Reagan had of course poor eyesight and it was noticed, the ability of the machines to print in large font was noticed, so the Altos were kept in the Executive Office of the President after the change of administration in 1980.
You're talking about getting machines out at GE Law from Stanford. I had supervised Alan Gorn in Caesars on Smalltalk, and then I lobbied very hard for Stanford to get Altos. And eventually we got them, and I was very happy when at the last minute it turned out that, I think it was Xerox lawyers, decided not to release Smalltalk. And I think if Xerox had released Smalltalk to Stanford, MIT, CMU, the universities that got each 24 Altos, I think at the time, our students had been able to use it, we would have had a different future of programming languages, less reliable. Less reliance on C++ with its problems. So for me, that's a very frustrating part of not releasing.
This Alto, that's a Stanford Alto, by the way, that one there.
So it doesn't have small talk on it.
There's no small talk. excuse
me. Several people have commented about secretaries using Altos, and there's a very short story about that I'd like to tell. When the Alto was being designed, there were two different keyboard layouts in common use, specifically with respect to what was on the symbols were on the shift side of the digits. There was the programmer's terminal, where the shift digit assignment was based on the ASCII character codes. And then there was the customary typewriter layout, where the symbols were a little different. The one that I remember is that on a standard typewriter, the ampersand is over the 7. On an ASCII keyboard, the ampersand is over the 6. And and people, you know, sort of started on the assumption, well, you know, without thinking, right, we know we're used to these teletypes that have the ASCII layout, we'll just do the Alto keyboard that way. And I pushed really hard. I said, look, if we want these machines to be used by people other than programmers, the keyboard has to have the standard typewriter assignment of the symbols. And there was an extended discussion about that, and I won. Yeah. And I like to think that that made perhaps some small difference in how well they were accepted by the secretaries.
Go ahead, Bruce.
I have a story about the Alto. The Alto actually meant quite a bit to me personally and to my family, as it turns out. Bruce was mentioning that Maze War is a very heart-stopping game. Well, it's also a labor-inducing game. And it turns out that in 1977, my wife was pregnant, and she was about 2 weeks overdue. And one night we were sitting around just bored, so we said, well, let's go down to the park and play Maze War. And so we did, and there was the usual half dozen or so people out there playing on the net. And it's such a tension-inducing game that as we were playing, she went into labor, and that very night, she delivered our first child.
There you go.
So did you name him or her Maze War?
That was successful, Mike.
My other observation for Peter Deutsch is, I was a Lisp programmer and worked on a timeshare at PDP 10 at Stanford. And yes, we used to go in to work at about 10 or 11 at night when all the other researchers were off machining because it was timeshare. And we could actually run our large Lisp programs without everyone complaining to us about it. But when the Alto came out, they used to say that my favorite sort of quote that they said at Park was,
the great thing about personal computers is that they don't run slower at night.
They don't run faster at night.
They don't run faster at night. Right. Jim Morris, I think.
Jim Morris,
who later went on to many distinguished positions, including the head of the CMU
Computer Science Department,
had wonderful, wonderful sayings. A saying of his that I find myself quoting constantly is, the great thing about standards is that there's so many of them to choose from.
Everyone has their own.
Ken?
So I just want to ask you guys a question that was asked me a few weeks ago. Was, when the original Dynabook concept came up, was there any talk about stylus or pen-based use of a Dynabook? And was there any thought about wireless communication?
With stylus, yes. In fact, the original Dynabook didn't have a keyboard, and Alan's notion was if you wanted to type, you would display a keyboard picture at the bottom of the bitmap, and then either touch sensitive. I don't know how much he got into whether it was a stylus or whether it was a touch screen or whatever. But and in fact, he was interested in touch screens for a long time. The note taker had a touch screen on it. And so that he regarded keyboards as kind of a compromise. With respect to wireless communication, an interesting thing to me is that the Dynabook vision, and this may just be my reading of it, but the Dynabook vision doesn't talk very much about communication. It does a little bit peer-to-peer in terms of the things that you can do that today would be instant messaging or email or something, but never talked a whole lot about the kind of what we now use computers for a lot, which is getting at all this stuff that's out there. He talked about, in fact, in Personal Dynamic Media, there's a bunch of stuff about how much of your library you could store on the, you know, in the thing. And so there wasn't this notion that it's a it's an appliance kind of to get at all this stuff. And in fact, the communications aspects of it that wireless would be. Now, to the extent that there was communication, yeah, Alan would definitely want it to be more wireless, because his whole idea was that you were out in the park with this thing, you know, and we had pictures. There was, in fact, it'd be interesting to find the young girl who was the kind of poster girl for Dynabook, who they took these pictures of sitting with a cardboard mock-up, which didn't have a keyboard, you know, out in the grass with her. And so clearly any communication that there was would have had been wireless.
By the way, the model for Ethernet was AlohaNet, which was a wireless network. And the reason that it's called Ethernet, of course, is because the simulation of the ether that is in the radio spectrum inside a coax cable. That's why it's called Ethernet. So it is originally a wireless concept.
Yeah, and what's the last thing the Dynabook does when it's falling off the cliff? Is it orders the new Dynabook? I
mean, one of the other people in NRG was Ted Kaler, who drew a wonderful, wonderful set of cartoons about the Dynabook, and that was one of them.
Yeah. By the way, the Knowledge Navigator video, which I guess Knowledge Navigator was a derivative concept piece at Apple that Alan was involved with, but we have that on the DigiBar site, and it's a really nice cardboard mock-up as well.
Mm-hmm. Better quality cardboard.
Which do you think is a true successor of Alto? Apple Lisa or Xerox Star?
The perk.
I think that when the Mac came out, I felt that I had an Alto. I don't think that Lisa had captured the essence of the Alto, and Sony Star hasn't. But I've seen Mac, that at least that's my feeling. And I bought the Mac right away.
I've never used a Lisa, never used a Star. I have only used a Mac very, very briefly. The way I would answer that question is to say that.
What did you use?
Sorry?
What did you use in your home life, in your civilian life?
DOS-based and later Linux-based.
Okay, that's an answer.
With Intel processors.
That's an answer.
But the way I would answer the question is to say that in terms of the sort of the LRG personal dynamic media vision, the Mac is the successor. In terms of the hardware and in terms of the business applications vision, the Star is the successor. I mean, among the successors. Oh,
yeah, and in different directions, they both cleaned up and regularized some of the things that were first demonstrated with the Alto and in Smalltalk and other systems, and they both represented a very taking those basic ideas and really bulletproof.
Okay, I now realize why I said I think you guys are correct in your statements, but I'm not realizing why I said what I've said, and I was really referring to one particular aspect of the Alto philosophy, which I don't think it has a name, but the opposite of it has a name, which is called biggerism. And this was Chuck Decker's favorite term, that you don't want to bigger your machine. And the Alto was the first machine, which when I earlier talked about Chuck Decker and his contribution, it was to fight against biggerism. And I think that the Mac was the first machine of that lineage. Both the Star and the Lisa suffered from biggerism squared or cubed, depending on which machine, but depending on your opinion. But I think that the Mac was this backlash and a very positive backlash to and captured the Chuck Thacker spirit of simplicity and focus. And which was, of course it was Steve Jobs. Steve Jobs was playing that role, which was his incredible force and contribution on his part.
Right. Although when you get done, were any of you at the famous demo for Steve Jobs, and what happened?
Larry Tesler was at the demo. I wasn't there.
Larry Tesler also did the CIA one.
Yeah, I was actually
in a trench coat.
I was at the Bill Gates demo that nobody knows about.
So, but I was just going to say, in terms of the star, I think that from the aspect of the user interface metaphor, it also was a anti-biggerist system.
Arguably.
By the way, the search software is running upstairs on 5G, so
yeah, well, do you have
is it running Maze War?
It is actually running Maze War.
Is it?
Does it?
In terms of the whole Apple thing, was there much meeting of the minds of the Mac designers and you guys, or any?
Oh, absolutely. I was at, you know, we are talking about much later in the sequence, but at that time when the Mac was created, I was working at Microsoft, and people don't realize that, of course, the Mac people had this logo which was a pirate logo. You might recall, and. But people don't realize that they were pirates against the rest of Apple. They weren't pirates that were opposed to Microsoft. In fact, Microsoft had as many software people on the Mac project, which amounted to about 10, as Apple did, which amounted to about 10. And so those people worked very close together. And I think there was a complete meeting of minds on the focus and the simplification and just making the on the concept of who the user is and mass market appeal. I think that was a tremendous project.
I think in both the covers at the end of Steve Jobs book, it was recognized that it was against the rest of the Apple economy, against the rest of the world.
You're right.
Charles, can you explain us the lineage of Bravo X to Word?
Well, it's there's legally there's no lineage, otherwise we'd be in a Word is of course is the program that made a lot of money. So we have to be careful not to connect it up with anything.
But fortuitously, it has an R in it.
Word. Okay, you're like R. Yeah. So the Bravo and Bravo X were Bravo was just the first version, and Bravo X used the microcode capability and created a bytecoded implementation for BCPL that it could run on and increase the performance. So I mean, this is a technical detail, but it actually connects up.
You're right. I sure
that was called
that.
Butte.
Yeah.
You know, Butte, which is the worn down Mesa. But anyway, so it was really the last version. That was the Bravo X was the one that was deployed in Washington D.C. and Sweden, for example, and that was probably the something that you could present to customers and actually expect them to pay for it. I don't think we ever asked for money because we didn't have the authority. But I think if we did, we could have, and we would have. Which I made very well. In fact, there is a machine upstairs, which is Bob Belleville's homebrew machine, which is kind of worth looking at it. Bob Belleville was one of the engineers on Star, and at home he created an Alto using an 8086 chip, which was very new and very expensive at the time, but much less expensive than an Alto. And essentially, he created a cheap Alto with all kinds of he had voice in it and so on. There's a I mean, it's a very interesting thing to look at. Yeah, and I discussed, yeah. And oh, sorry, right. It's in a storage. And I discussed with Bob to go into business that he would build the machine and I would build the software that would have been Bravo XI or something. I don't know.
Can you talk about the relationship between Bravo and Word?
Well, when I went to Microsoft, my standard line was that at Xerox I made a lot of mistakes. Fortunately, they were proprietary mistakes. That means that under penalty of law, I must never make them again. So basically, that's the connection between the two.
That was really good.
Excellent.
Very, very good.
In terms of the evolution of the software itself, would you say Alto's biggest contribution is WYSIWYG? Or you said something earlier about Alto being primarily a software machine. Is it one of the first machines to actually be mostly a software machine?
Well, let's try and put that a bit in perspective. Actually, the Argus 700, which was a machine that I worked on at Ferranti, and those of you who know about Ferranti will know that it was really quite an amazing company, because some of the world's first big computers came out of there, as well as some of the most imaginative computers, I believe. And that machine actually was programmed in a high-level language, namely Pascal. And the Argus 700 also had went from an ECL 10K. Remember, does anybody remember ECL? Yeah. Does anybody work with ECL? By the way, this is not why I broke my wrist, but could have been the reason. Awful, awful. But anyway, that machine was a multiprocessor. Top of the line was ECL, bottom of the line was TTL. Yeah. And it was a fully distributed machine. But the most important thing that happened when I arrived in Xerox was the realization that this machine was entirely dedicated to this flexibility. And so everything about the sort of Ferranti Manchester University School of Computer Engineering, even though I was actually from Edinburgh University, which had under Sidney Michelson an extremely interesting view of computer architectures. So if you want to sort of look back in time, the thing that was really interesting to me about the Alto was the fact that of this flexibility that, you know, everybody's talked about. And frankly, you know, if you actually sort of dig right into it, the thing that really is extraordinary, square pixels, was that flexibility. Because, you know, as this group here has, I think, incredibly well illustrated, there were so many different views that the Alto had to its programmers, and indeed to its users. It was an incredibly flexible machine. But what was so important about it was, looking at it, I really got the feeling that this was something that people could personally have. And that was, I think, a major, major thing that Butler did, and that Alan Kay, you know, who's
one more name, Bob Taylor.
And Bob Taylor, getting to Bob.
Bob Taylor, yeah. It was why did Butler write that memo?
Yeah.
Butler didn't write that memo because it came to him one day. It's because Bob Taylor asked him to write something about personal computing. And in fact, when Chuck and Butler talked to Bob first, Bob wasn't he was a psychologist by training. He wasn't a technical person, and he tend to talk in strange metaphors and kind of, one might say, psychobabble. So it took Butler and Chuck many weeks to understand what the hell he was talking about.
But let me just, what he actually said, what I was going to say. Park, I think, had amazing visionaries, and I think Bob was certainly one of them. Very, very strong. And of course, Bill English, who came from Doug Engelbart's group. Is Bill still here? Yeah. Well, Bill, Doug Engelbart, who started in 68, as you know, so he showed the mouse, showed video conferencing, quite a lot of things. And what was really extraordinary to me at that part was the fact that it actually pulled together a whole series of experiences from all over the world, and a lot of it got focused on this little machine. And so the fact that we had a lot of them and that had different personalities and could be deployed in these different ways and ultimately showed that it could be lowered in cost was, I think, an extraordinary and very, very exciting thing. But it was a programmer's delight, I think, because of that flexibility. And but subsequently, they've not been that way. I'm going to say just one more thing, and then we go. But I'm going to get back to this point about, you know, everybody fingering Xerox and saying, well, they really, you know, flubbed the future and did those things. And you know, I started and run three companies now, and I can tell you that focusing on your thing and knowing what your central tendency really is and protecting that thing and doing that thing incredibly well is absolutely key to that company. That's key to its survival. And if you look back, Xerox was a copy and duplicator company. It bet its ass to do the first copy and duplicator. Most people don't realize that A.D. Little said there's no market for copy and duplicators. And they still went ahead and did it. And by the way, the person that did it was C. Peter McCullough, who I had the honor to work for personally when we did Futures Day. And working with C. Peter at that time, I realized that this company that we were in was under immense stress. You know, we were doing Futures Day for him, which was his opportunity to say, hey, we could do all these things, but also at Futures Day, that Boca Raton meeting, they said, well, we're going to put off doing those things because we have this BFP, which I learned in the government means a breach by foreign power, but I thought it meant something else in the model. You know, they had this huge problem. They were being eaten alive by the low-end copy of duplicators. They'd invested a ton of money in doing, I think it was Moses, which actually had sunk more development dollars than it cost to do the 747. I mean, this is a huge thing that they were doing in competition with what they thought was IBM and Kodak. What I'm saying is that Xerox was in terrible trouble at the time that they were trying to deal with us. And they were left in part with these great ideas. Now, what they should have done and didn't do, and they've analyzed extensively since, and I looked at this because, you know, I was asked to, you know, when Parker spun out, to talk with Dave and others about, well, what should the future management be like? And so I sort of dug back into the past a bit, and there's lots and lots of analysis that said, well, spinning something out is very hard, you know, doing it right. You can either just let the people go, okay, and try and get something back, or you can concentrate very hard on doing that spinning out. And I'll give you one story from Grid Days, which has, you know, that's maybe going to be another session at some other time, because you're going to have birthdays forever. But, you know, Grid, we did our own software. You know, and then when the IBM PC came out, we had to have a PC compatible machine, and we came up, and Charles was there, and we saw Bill, and Bill said, yeah, I'll do a special version of MS-DOS for you. And that saved the company. And we seriously considered spinning our software effort out at that time. Apple was interested in buying it. This is a mobile computing system. Those of you who have looked at the Grid operating system and the common code and everything else that went with it, that was incredibly important. And in a way, we kind of failed the test, I believe, because we should have spun our software out, kept our specialized custom software effort going with people we work with. You know, we all know about NASA and White House Communications Agency. But basically, we did a huge amount of work with people in how to automate the sales force. We could have done all of that in unison with Microsoft, and the world would probably have been quite different. In other words, if we'd focused on what was our real strength, which is really compact, really connected, wireless connected, as they were starting to be, personal computers that were truly personal, in other words, you could carry them around with you. If we'd focused on that, maybe the world would still know Grid systems. But the most important thing was that we looked at what it would take to spin us out, to spin that software out. And we were fighting the war. We had to deal with the IBM PC. So we had to get a special version of MS-DOS. We had to quickly switch our customer base across to that. We had to eat a lot of crow. We actually decided to keep Grid OS going because the cost of spinning it out in terms of management effort was too great. And I look back and I say, probably that's what happened to Xerox as well. Xerox looked and they said, hey, we're being eaten alive. We're losing market share big time. It's usually in Europe. and starting to be in the United States. We've really got to do something about it. Let's just let this thing sort of go on and fritter away. But they sort of, you know, had the spin thing, which was not quite the frittering away, but we can't do the spin-outs that would have been required. And they couldn't really attend to Star either. So I look back and I say, well, Star sort of survived, but really to support the laser printer stuff that Gary unfortunately couldn't be here to talk about. And what came out of Park was laser printers. So I look back and I say, maybe they made the right call.
Well, I'm Jeff Thompson. There in fact was one very successful spin-out, although Xerox did not keep much of a stake in it, and that was the Ethernet. They spun out Synoptics, which basically took Ethernet and migrated the technology to 10BASE-T, which enormously grew the Ethernet market, and Synoptics was a very, very successful company for a number of years. There's been something that's been alluded to very heavily about the Alto, but I think I'd like to make it even more explicit. I was one of the first civilian users. I got the first or second machine in the second build when I was working for Gary Starkweather on laser printing. I wasn't a programmer, that's for sure. And that is that the very simplicity of the Alto, which is excruciatingly simple, and the fact that it was one of the very first machines to use semiconductor memory, bitmap display into main memory, all of the things that Thacker stripped out of the hardware to have any character, so that he had a machine which was the computer equivalent, when you look at the screen, of a blank piece of paper. And blank pieces of paper were the business of Xerox. Before the Alto was built, computers were not built to put a blank piece of paper in front of a user. And the Alto did that, and that is its enormous strength, and that's why it's such a significant pioneer.
Exactly. I think we're going to take about another 5 minutes of questions. Just at 3:30, we're going to do our little birthday cake thing up upstairs, and then you guys can, hopefully some of the speakers can stay on and meet with you more so socially. There's a question right in the way in the back here.
I kind of disagree. I think that is the blankness idea is a historical idea, and it, what it does, it enables a Cambrian explosion. But when you have a Cambrian explosion, it doesn't mean that all the specialized animals will survive. But what will happen is that some tremendously specialized but proven to be useful machines survive, and I think that the PC is one of those. So I think that it's justified for things to be internally more specialized and more complex. Of course, for the point of view of the user, I think that there are some other rules. But I don't think that blank pieces of paper sell forever. What blank pieces of paper do, they enable these experiences and experimentation with applications and business models and whatever and now we know exactly what are the important applications within the computer paradigm. So I don't think further simplification of computers is in the cards. There would be tremendous excitement around computers and the use and application of computers and the integration of home appliances and of course the access to the network and using network services and all of those things. But as far as computers, I think that computers are pretty irrelevant. The chips are getting better. Nobody's talking about what the opcodes are anymore. And in fact, they are completely irrelevant.
I'd like to also take a swing at answering that question. I think just a very few years ago, there was a new kind of blank or nearly blank media, and that was the PDA. because I don't know, I don't know what the internal architecture of a typical PDA was, but in terms of being a new computer genus that would that required at least somewhat different thinking about how to approach making it useful to the user, I think it had some of the blank paper quality that was characterized so well. I think it's gone through its gone through its cycle of explosion and winnowing much more quickly. I think there is still more competition for what the PDA experience feels like than there is for what the desktop experience feels like. But the blank paper quality is already several years in the past. I agree with Charles up to a point that the blank paper quality for what we think of as a computer, or for what we think of as a desktop computer with a screen, that era, that's something that only happens once. It's like the Cambrian explosion. I disagree very strongly with the notion that we know what all the important applications are.
Within that paradigm, that's all I was saying.
Ah, okay. All right, then
that's what I meant, yeah. I agree with you. Okay. I think it's a very good point to clarify. And I didn't make that clear.
Okay, all right. I think there are other paradigms that, based on different roles of different kind of positioning of and different experiences of computing in our life.
Right, absolutely.
We don't know much of anything about those yet.
Right. That's where the interest is. That's where the interest lies for the future.
Question here.
Would you each complete a sentence for us? And that would be, happy 30th birthday, Alto. I am so glad you were born because.
I'm so glad you were born because I got my language coach.
Despite the complete lack of any connection between Bravo X and Word.
Anybody else?
Well, I'm obviously very glad I was born because I really think it made a huge contribution to the world.
I guess I would have to say I'm glad it was born because it opened up the opportunity for it kind of led the way in demonstrating that computers could feel much more hospitable to people other than technologists.
Well, I'll be really selfish. I'm glad it was born because it provided me the most fun 10 years of my life. The first 10 years I worked at Park, working on this were like getting paid to be your hobby. In fact, it scarred me for the rest of my life because that was my first job, and I thought that's what work was like. But it was there was nothing more fun than taking a blank sheet of paper and having an idea about things you could do with it, and then going and doing that with a bunch of other really interesting and high-powered people. It was fantastic.
John, I think we have chance for one more question right in the center here.
I think it's not really a question, but the park provided a Disneyland for programmers. It was ideal, and I think their fundamental mistake was not opening it up to third-party developers. I mean, I think Jurassic Park was actually successful because the seed pod exploded, and the seeds went all over, and that's how it spread. But if they would have taken, supported third-party developers and let other people play in this playground, the results would have been absolutely even multiplied even more.
Yeah, but you can't do it without the machines. The machine was a proprietary machine. And,
Yes, the two mistakes were tied together.
Yeah,
well, fine. I mean,
I want to connect them up.
Think you have seen they need to solve both of those.
Make it explicit.
And with that, I want to thank you all for, and thank the panelists, and thank all the organizers, and Salam, and the Computer History Museum for doing this, making this fantastic facility for all of us to capture the story of the history of our medium, and invite you all in maybe 10 or 20 minutes just to come back, to come up into the exhibits, go through into the back, and we'll have a little birthday cake ceremony, and all park people must sign this book, please.
And we thank Bruce and Ben. Thank
you. By the way, I read your website, Ben in Czechoslovakia.
Oh, in Czechoslovakia. Good job.
Oh, Sebastian.
Thank you very much, John.